I think it was back in 1982, when I was a lot younger than today. 17 years old, I was a little, I think, very nervous young fan, attending his first international con, which was then gladly Eurocon in Mönchengladbach. And I remember me, my younger self, standing there and looking up to all those people, and one upon them was John Brunner. I don't know what would have happened to that little boy 10 years ago if he had known that 10 years later he would sit beside John Brunner on a panel and asking him questions. I just remember going to him very shyly and looking up and said, "Please, Mr. Brunner, could you please sign these books?" And he did. I was absolutely amazed, and I was in heaven for nearly 2 hours just standing there. So I'm a little bit nervous myself because I hope I don't lose all this boyish nervousness in the 10 years.
You think you're nervous? What about me?
I think you're doing it a lot of years. You told me you started as a science fiction fan. I don't know how long ago. Could you say some words to your career? I've read once about John Brunner. John Brunner is the only science fiction author whose books are getting better all the time. And I was thinking, I'd like to read some of his books 20 years back. Might be interesting. How did you start? Was there a young John Brunner writing, bad stories about ugly aliens invading Earth and trying to steal our women?
I don't think so, but it's possible. It's possible. I started my first science fiction story when I was a very small boy indeed. I'd run out of science fiction to read. It occurred to me that I should write a story, then I could read it afterwards. I remember two things about it. It featured a Martian called Gloop, which I think was not an ideal choice of name, and I couldn't figure out how to put an ending on it. That is a problem I still have. Yes, it is quite true that I was a science fiction fan before I became a published writer. I think a lot of people in science fiction came up from fandom. I don't remember exactly how it was that I became involved in correspondence with other science fiction fans. I think it was probably through a magazine called Operation Fantast, run by Kenneth F. Slater, who happily is still with us and has achieved another fanish dream. He has made his living for many, many years operating a science fiction mail order service. This magazine of his circulated in other countries. This was at a time when, in Britain and indeed in Europe, dollars were very hard to come by, so American fans would sometimes send copies of American magazines to Europe, and their fanzines as well as the professional magazines. I managed to get hold of some of these. I started writing to American fans. And by the time I was 16 or so, I had quite an extensive list of correspondents. But it wasn't until I was 17 that I sold my first short novel.
I have read in your biography that your first years as a writer were very hard. There's something about I learned to cook potatoes in a lot of ways. Can you tell us about, I think you sold your first story and it took a long while till you became able to live by selling stories.
Yes, that's quite true. After I'd done my Air Force service, during which I did not write at all, I wrote a little, but I didn't sell anything, I moved up to London under the mistaken impression I was already a writer. And as Herman correctly says in my autobiography, I mentioned that I learned an awful lot of ways of cooking potatoes, because the rent on my room was half what I was making per week. And I wasn't even paying any tax, because the tax man hadn't found out I existed. He did. And in the end, I had a stroke of great luck. I'm sure you know the work of the British writer John Christopher. At that time, he was working for an industrial diamond company in London. The phone rang one morning when I was pretty much prepared to leave London and go back to my parents' home. He was trying to find a friend of mine for whom I didn't have an address. I said, why? He said, well, my boss has gone to hospital. I've got to do his job, and I'm looking for somebody to do mine. And I said, how about me? He said, fine, come around tomorrow. So the following Monday, I started on a job that paid me very nearly three times as much per week as I was making by writing. I didn't exactly feel rich, but at least I didn't have to eat potatoes at every meal any longer. I was even able to go out to a Chinese restaurant now and then. Where one, the one I have in mind was particularly useful. It was in a part of London where I could take a bus from where I was staying, go down, do my shopping at the weekend, drop into this restaurant, and for what would it be today, the equivalent of about 1.25 mark, eat so much that I didn't feel hungry again until lunch the following day. I was very grateful to that restaurant. And after I'd worked for John Christopher for about 6 months, the boss came back. By that time, I'd secured a job with a publishing house through a friend of John Christopher's. Unfortunately, it was not the kind of publishing house with which I wished to become permanently associated. It was founded by a man who is now a multimillionaire. His name is Paul Hamlin, whose declared ambition was to sell books as though they were cakes of soap. I stayed there for 2 years. At the end of that time, I sold my first paperback novel to America, to the Ace Doubles, and resigned my job from the hospital bed where I was recovering from having my appendix out, much to the alarm of my wife, whom I'd married in the summer of that year, my first wife, Marjorie, who thought I was pretty crazy to be involved in science fiction anyway, and this confirmed it.
But you have been one of the best-selling science fiction authors for the last 10 years, and you are one of the best-selling English science fiction authors in Germany. You came quite used to being a guest of honor on a lot of conventions. I have an article from you about being treated as a guest of honor, and it states how fans should act towards a guest of honor. I remember me standing there with great eyes, which is, of course, I think, embarrassing for the authors, having 50 people looking up, and I can feel a bit of it sitting up here and all these people. I don't know what to say. Can you tell us something about the feeling, the change of your feelings from being a fan, writing stories, and then becoming a professional author, becoming someone to from the other side, so to say?
I don't think I'm on the other side, goodness me. The article which Hammond just referred to is entitled On the Care and Feeding of a Guest of Honor, and it derived from certain events which illustrated what you should not do to a guest of honor. I won't bore you with all the disasters that I've suffered through. I might illustrate one, though. There was a convention in France organized by some people who had never held a convention before, never even, as far as I know, been to a convention. They arranged it partly in the some sort of municipal building, I forget which. Probably somewhere rather like this, a cultural center. Partly in a deserted tobacco factory, about 20 minutes walk in one direction, Partly in somewhere else, a basement in another direction, about 15 minutes walk away. And then scheduled me to make successive appearances in different places. They also did not put a car at my disposal, and my then wife had leg trouble. She had a blocked artery in her leg. And one way and another, we were not entirely happy with that convention committee, particularly when we discovered, on the basis of the people who bothered to attend, and there weren't many of those, they could have put the entire convention into the hotel where we were staying, which had small conference rooms in the basement, and a brasserie across the road, which was big enough for the city jazz club to hold its meetings there. Last I heard of that convention committee, they were still paying off their debts. And I'm not surprised. There was the occasion at one of the Metz festivals, also in France, when, well, I must admit they had been rather badly treated by an American guest of honor. I wasn't a guest of honor that year, I was just an ordinary guest. And the American guest of honor didn't bother to turn up for his guest of honor speech. He was out in the country sightseeing because he'd never been to France before. And that's an example of what the guest of honor can do to the committee. But that committee took it out on other people. I was scheduled to do my spiel on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. I said I would like a microphone and somebody to introduce me. Here's a note about myself. I'd like somebody to say this in French, please. I got there 10 to 3. Nobody from the committee, no microphone. We waited. 10 past 3, I got bored, so did the audience. So I shoveled them all into the front rows, said, come up here where you can hear me without a microphone, except I said it in French. And then I said some very rude things about the convention committee, and then I went ahead. And afterwards, the explanation given for the committee not turning up was, well, we were sure you could manage by yourself. They no longer hold Metz science fiction festivals. There was the convention in... Now, I wasn't a guest at this one, but I can imagine what the guest of honor felt when he was sober, which was very, very seldom. In fact, that was the occasion when the gentleman became so drunk at 2 o'clock in the morning, he thought the convention hospitality suite was his bedroom and ordered everybody else out. So you see, guest of honor can be an embarrassment to the committee as well as the other way around. But that was the convention at which, for example, they were holding a dance on Saturday night. At 10:30, they still hadn't figured out how to make their tape recorder play the recorded music. I and the lady I was with had become hungry quite a long time before. In the end, at 10:30, we went to the hotel dining room because it was advertised in the lifts and the elevators as closing at 11 o'clock. We got there at 10:30. We were told we were too late. 11 o'clock means 10:30, didn't you know? And there really was nowhere open within a mile, so we were very hungry that night. I discovered the following day part of the reason for this incredible inefficiency. Oh, the number of things that went wrong. Forget it. I overheard a quarrel between two members of the committee, and one of them said to the other, I've got a piece of this convention, and don't you forget it. In other words, they were running it not out of the fannish kindness of their hearts, but to make a profit. The result, of course, was that they gave the smallest possible value and took away the largest possible amount of money. When the gentleman in question was sentenced to a year in jail for illicit sexual intercourse with an underage girl, I felt it was nothing more than he deserved. I am not a believing Christian, but the Bible is an excellent source of quotes. And I'm thinking about the one that about not gathering figs from thistles. Yes. Oh, I still haven't answered your question. You asked me, how does it feel to be on the other side? I'm not on the other side, damn it. Or if I am, nobody's ever told me. I made my first real friends through science fiction. I've made many very long-lasting friends through science fiction. And thanks to science fiction conventions, I've enjoyed a luxury denied to most other writers of fiction. Very, very few writers have any contact with their readership. I remember in Britain years ago, when I lived in London, but must be 20, 21 years ago, the Crime Writers Association, to which I also belonged, had decided to hold an international congress. I said to the Lady Treasurer, we are holding our science fiction convention at Easter. Why don't you come and see if you pick up any ideas? She said, fine. And she came to our convention, and I saw her at the closing banquet at the end of the weekend. And I said, how is it going? She said, oh, I have had a marvelous time. But there's nothing here for us. We can't count on this level of support from the readership. In the end, they hired an international convention bureau and had it done professionally. No, it is a wonderful thing to be a science fiction writer. And know that if you go to a convention, you can walk in, put your luggage in your room, and 10 minutes later be talking with somebody you've never met before about your work. We get more feedback than anybody in any other line of business in the writing field, that is. And what's more, people do it voluntarily. I mean, they're not dragooned. They don't sort of come in here by the class load or the factory load or the foreman in charge saying, now each of you in turn will go to this author and ask him for an autograph. Mark you, people do come up and ask for autographs. I've been to a number of signing sessions. I remember one in Portland, Oregon, where nobody turned up at all. I sat there reading science fiction. It was in a bookshop for 2 hours, and then I asked to be taken back to the hotel. The proprietor of the bookshop had overlooked the fact that everybody who might have wanted an autograph from a science fiction writer was at the science fiction convention. He should have been there. He should have shut his shop. I was once at a signing session at a convention with Isaac Asimov. And I arrived, and there was a line of maybe 20 or 30 people in front of Isaac Asimov. I sat down, and so did somebody else. I forget who. And the line in front of Isaac Asimov remained about 20 or 30 long. 20 or 30 long. You looked up after 10 minutes, you know. Oh yes, 20 or 30 people in front of Isaac Asimov. And every now and again, somebody, after having a book signed by Isaac, look around and say, oh, yes, I've got one here by you, I think. I had a very lazy time, but poor Isaac. Well, he enjoyed it. There's no doubt he enjoyed it. But the signing session that I enjoyed the most was at one of the Metz festivals, where the guy who does Valerian was signing copies of his cartoon albums, Mézières. And he was putting a little sketch on the flyleaf of each book that he signed, a little drawing. And after a while, he ran out of ideas, so I started giving him suggestions. And then Harlan Ellison arrived and sat down on the other side. He was half an hour late, but that's Harlan all over. And he started making suggestions, too. And the suggestion got wilder. And Mézières would sit there, And eventually, Harlan made a suggestion that he liked so much the result of. He grabbed the album back and said, you go buy another. I'm having this one. And one way and another, that is the pleasantest signing session I have ever enjoyed. And Mézières became a good friend. And I haven't seen him since the last time I was in Chicoutimi. Golly. Well, he's still around.
You said that you're able to speak French, but you also studied German, and you are able to speak German rather fluently, I discovered yesterday. And you also translated French and German books in English, Rilke, for example. And I told that someone yesterday, and he said, someone who translates Rilke must speak German perfectly.
Ländlich ist das nicht wahr. Ich habe Deutsch in der Schule studiert, aber vor 40 Jahren erst. Und zu Hause in Somerset habe ich nur sehr selten die Gelegenheit, mich für Deutsch zu üben. Damit ist mein Wortschatz viel vermindert. Hier muss ich Wort nach Wort übersetzen. Damit geht es so, so langsam. Es ist viel mehr einfach, Englisch zu sprechen. Aber wenn man mir eine... No, I'm going back into English, I'm sorry. because if I don't say the next bit now, I shall forget it. The fact that I did very successfully translate one poem by Rainer Maria Rilke, it's Corrida, disguises the fact that it took me 16 years to finish it. This is not the basis for a professional career. But actually, I am very proud of that translation. It goes line for line, rhyme for rhyme with the original. English, of course, and German being slightly different. Not exactly a match. But when it comes to the ending, where Rilke put in all those wonderful long O's, über die wiederhergerollten Woge, über dem verlorenen Stoße, I managed to put in even more.
What's the English translation of that?
I wish you hadn't asked me that. I didn't bring it with me. I'll see if I can remember before the end of the afternoon.
Oh, just a line with the O's.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to remember.
I
got it. Sinks in that breaking roller, still showing, I lost the next word. Blown now and slowing the almost kindly sharpness of his sword. Sinks in that breaking roller, still showing, I think it must be loathing, still showing loathing, blown now and slowing the almost kindly sharpness of his sword, which I was quite pleased with.
You're one of the most known English authors in Germany. Is there a special link that you like by learning German or by so much thinking about the German language that you acquired some of the, like a kindness? You are writing, the Germans are, your books seem to appeal to German readers. Do you think there's a kinship or something between you and your readers, so it makes them so easy to be read in German?
No, I don't think so. I think the explanation is probably much more that the concerns that are reflected in my books are the concerns of most people living in industrialized Western Europe. My major theme is, in science fiction, the misapplication of technology. And few places in the world have seen it more misplaced than this country, Germany. First by the development of an enormous war machine in the 30s, then by the consequences of that, then by, in part of the country at least, pollution running out of control, the consequences of unwise industrialization. And it's, well, I could say, my books apparently do quite well in Japan, though I'm busy trying to find out why I never seem to get any money from there. But a number of people have told me that my books sell well in Japan. That also is a country where technology is being misapplied on the grand scale. The Japanese industrial boom, I think, is going to go pop, and it may even have started to go pop, because there is a limit to what people with money to pay for them can absorb in the way of hi-fis and televisions and pocket calculators and all the rest of it. There's simply a limit to what people with money in their pocket to pay you back can absorb. I suppose one could visualize a society in which people brought you round your weekly computer. Certainly, back in the days when this problem first became apparent, many writers envisaged your weekly car being delivered, purely in the interests of trying to keep people in work. This is not a viable mode of procedure. I think the misapplication of technology, insofar as it is my central theme, may perhaps account for the fact that people in highly industrialized nations do find my work interesting.
Oh, you touched another topic. You were also a very political man. You not only wrote science fiction, you also wrote an anthem for the anti-nuclear movement, the H-bomb thunder. Yes. You have written a lot of books with political topics. I think industrialization is also a political topic. Oh, who is here? Is a political man also writing science fiction? Or is a science fiction writer getting more and more aware politically? Or are there two John Brunners, or one always changing back between both?
No, my work is a continuum. But as I said at the panel yesterday on politics and science fiction, I'd got sick and tired of science fiction which simply ignored political and economic influences. After all, one of the definitions of a human being is the political animal. I didn't set out to be a writer of political science fiction. I merely wanted to write science fiction that was that much more realistic because it included the political and the economic dimensions. I'm glad to say that this struck people as sufficiently important for them to keep some of my books of that kind in print for several years. But no, I don't think I ever set out to write political science fiction. I set out to write science fiction in which politics appeared the way politics appear in real life.
But I think most authors tend to forget the political influence. Who wrote one very famous book, Shockwave Rider, which was based on a book by Alvin Toffler. Correct. And it was, as I see it, the new thing was combining political science and science fiction, like writing the perfect utopia by the perfect utopian book by taking a non-fiction book and using it for a science fiction story.
Well, this has been done so many times and generally without success.
Why do you have the success with the story and all the others failed?
Well, let me take that in two levels. First of all, this is not a new idea in science fiction. Back in the 1930s, for example, there was strong support for the technocratic movement in the United States, right-wing authoritarian movement, dedicated to the notion that engineers could save the world. There were also trends like, Major Douglas's social credit movement, otherwise known as $30 every Thursday, which was very much like Mac Reynolds's People's Capitalism, He wrote stories against the people's capitalism background to show how people's capitalism wouldn't work, he being a dedicated socialist. But the idea of dramatizing political theories in science fiction is not by any means a new one. Insofar as, well, you say, I hope I succeeded where others failed, compared to things like Rimmer's The Harad Experiment and some Skinner wrote a, or Walden 2. These are overtly political science fiction novels, and they are terribly bad novels. Above all, of course, I was not intending to preach any political gospel. I merely wanted people to look at the world around them with a clearer eye and understand some of the political and economic forces changing our world. But always, always, I wanted the story to come first, damn it. If I put political opinions into my stories, I put them into the mouths of characters. They weren't my opinions. They were the opinions of characters within the book. I might sympathize with them, and it might show. But at least, in the context of the book, these opinions could be credibly held by somebody that I had made stand up on the page. You may perhaps have noticed, if you read Stand on Zanzibar, The Jagged Orbit, Sheep Look Up, and other of my stories. In order to save space, because the books are pretty long, in each of them I had an old wise man. It's very useful to have somebody in a book who's right. Even though he's not in the center of the action, he's always there to come along and say, "Oh, you bloody fool."
Kind of John Brunner walking through your books on...
Let's say a meta John Brunner.
maybe that the others, like Skinner, tried to get the message first and the story later, which makes them highly unreadable.
Yeah.
There was also, I think, always one of your very strong sides. As you told, I would like to read the story of The Martian. It might be the only one without an ending, because all the other books are strong fiction first, and they also have a good story. And most political books, science fiction books I've read, are strong meaning, strong politics, bad story. Do you get this quality by writing so much, or was it there from the beginning?
No, it wasn't there from the beginning. I wrote some very bad stories. Fortunately, those didn't get published. I was very, very lucky in my early career in that I got paid for publishing a lot of my mistakes. That's to say, books that should really have been put aside and left for couple of years till I was better able to handle the material, got published. They were moderately successful, and they paid for me to go on practicing, if you see what I mean. Later in my career, I often came back to them, I think about 12 or 14 times I've done this, and I've looked at one of my early stories and I've said, it deserved a better treatment. I'm not ashamed of what I did when I was still an apprentice. No, I did what I knew how to do at the time, but later I said to myself, that story deserved to be better handled. So I would revise it, expand it, improve the descriptions, the dialogue, the characterizations, maybe make some things clearer to the reader, which I hadn't spelled out properly the first time because I was in too much of a hurry. And in general, brought them up to my contemporary standard. I don't think I shall ever do that again, because the early stories that I wanted to rescue, I have rescued. But I feel it was well worth it, because I was always, from the beginning, a good storyteller. I wasn't necessarily a finished writer, but I did know how to tell a story, because I'd been practicing since I was sent away to boarding school at the age of 9. We weren't allowed to talk in the dormitory after they switched the lights out, but they did tolerate somebody telling a story until we went to sleep. And that's actually where I started telling stories, in the school dormitory after lights out.
Came a long way from there.
Yeah. I only have my wife sleeping in my room now, not 14 other boys.
Well, what are you writing in the moment? We're not rewriting your old books. Are you writing in something new? New science fiction novel?
Well, the last book that I've finished, which has gone to Avon in New York, I don't know who will publish it in Britain yet, is not exactly science fiction. It's a novel of suspense. It's set in the very near future. It might perhaps be next year or the year after. I no longer believe in our glorious future out there among the stars. I've become very cynical and disillusioned about our so-called civilization. In any case, I'd wanted to write this book for about 20 years, and it was high time. At present, I have written half of a book that is completely different again. I won't tell you much about it, because if I talk too much about a book I'm working on, when I actually write the material, it feels used, it feels second-hand. But I can tell you that it has an excellent title. I'm sure there are many people here who have read the works of Tolkien. I'm sure you know where the events took place in the works of Tolkien. Well, the title for my new book is Muddle Earth.
You told about your writing, Mr. Brunner, but what are you reading in the moment? What does a science fiction writer read? What are you spending your days with? Which books do fascinate you? Are you still reading science fiction or absolutely different things like books about birds or cars or things like that?
I'm glad you asked me that question, because I asked you to ask it, didn't I?
I remembered.
Oh, seriously. There is an ulterior motive behind this. I read very little science fiction nowadays, but that's because I read very little fiction of any kind. I read no less voraciously than I used to, but for the past maybe 15 years, it's been non-fiction to fiction about 4-1. The remark that I gave to Chad Mulligan in Stand on Zanzibar does reflect my own opinion. The real world has one unique characteristic. It, and only it, can take us completely by surprise. As a result, I've simply found myself reading more non-fiction, less fiction, at least in part because when I read somebody else's fiction, I find myself saying, I could have done that better. It may not be true, but my subconscious says, hang on, go back and revise that last page. It's not right. That takes quite a lot of the pleasure out of reading fiction. There are still some writers whose work I read with great enjoyment, but I won't go to that because I want, in fact, to mention some of the books I've been reading recently, and they're great fun. At present, I'm partway through the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language, and this is a wonderful sort of mental exercise for a writer to read a book of this kind. I went to the Dublin Science Fiction Convention a while ago in February, and I bought two books while I was there. I bought nothing else, just a couple of books, about the Irish language, because I knew nothing about it, except that there are an awful lot of letters that you simply don't pronounce. I wanted to find out why. And the Encyclopedia of Language is proving to be interesting, stimulating, and I hope it's going to be infuriating, because I'll get a story out of being infuriated. Another book that I enjoyed very much not long ago was by a guy called Ivars Pedersen, and it's called The Mathematical Tourist. I didn't have proper teaching in mathematics when I was at school, and I had no science teaching at all. But I've always been fascinated by the frontiers of human knowledge, and The Mathematical Tourist is an excellent conspectus of contemporary mathematics, the big problems and the recent big solutions. I enjoyed that very much. Another book that stimulated me very considerably was one with the charming title The Great Mambo Chicken and the Transhuman Condition. I'll say that again, you didn't believe it, did you? Great Mambo Chicken and the Transhuman Condition. It's by a guy called Ed Regis. He decided to go out and interview the people who are taking, quotes on a frontier science seriously, like the people who are being frozen in the hope that they will be revived in the far future. Like the people who are quite successfully building private spaceships. And I'm not joking. I don't mean manned spaceships, but I mean vehicles with satellite launching capacity. One in particular impressed me rather. I think most of them are slightly crazy, but here was one guy who really quite impressed me with his business acumen. He used to work for NASA. When he left, he raised some money somehow, and he bought some of the equipment he'd been working on at scrap value. 2 or 3 years later, NASA decided they needed this equipment after all, so they bought it back from him. And with the money he cleared on that deal, he was able to start building his own rocket ships. That man isn't crazy. But the one that's left the most abiding impression on me recently is one that was originally published several years ago now, I think 15. I missed it the first time round. It's by a guy called Julian James, who lectures in philosophy at Princeton. And it labors under the unwieldy title of The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. Could I say that one again? The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. He has a fascinating thesis to propound. I'm not sure I am completely convinced, but he has answered some questions I have been asking myself since I was a very small boy, such as, why did the ancient Greeks not know that they thought with their brains? How could they believe that they thought with their livers? I remember asking many of my friends, when I was a small boy, or in my teens perhaps, where are you? I know very well where I am. I'm between my temples and behind my eyes. I'm approximately cinemascope shaped. The rest of me is vehicle. It takes me around. I know that. I've known it all my life. Except when I'm working on a very successful book. I remember when I was writing Stand on Zanzibar. I was sitting at my typewriter, and I came down out of my head, down my arms and into my fingertips. That was a really psychedelic experience. Oh yeah. Wow. Occasionally I would run across somebody who said, but I'm all I. And this would be an athlete, a sprinter, or a jumper, or a footballer. He'd say, all of me is I. But the vast majority of my friends would say, yes, I'm where you are, I'm in my head. Why did the ancient Greeks not know this? Why is something so strange about what's come down to us from the ancient world? Professor James has a very interesting idea. His idea is that until comparatively recently, indeed until early historical times, the condition that we would now call schizophrenia was the norm among human beings. He suggests that this accounts for the fact that all early cultures, including, for example, the culture that gave us the Iliad, care more about the action of gods and the will of gods than about the will of human beings. He hypothesizes that, like present-day schizophrenics, even these proto-civilized human beings heard voices inside their heads all the time that were telling them what to do. That sometimes these came from an external authority figure. He has the interesting point, by the way, that the English word obey comes from the Latin I stand before and hear. There is the classic phrase, I hear and obey, as though the two words meant the same. Sometimes it might be an external authority figure. Sometimes it might be a wholly imaginary construct, a god or a goddess. I love this idea because it explains a great many things. He links it to the development of language. He suggests that essentially it's a split brain phenomenon. He also suggests that we can trace the loss of this omnipresence of the divine inside our heads through what survives in the way of literary fragments from the past. Between the Iliad, which is properly called the Wrath of Achilles, and is basically about the hero sulking in his tent and listening to the gods and goddesses squabbling about him. That's a real ego trip, isn't it? You're so important that all the gods and goddesses are arguing about what to do with you. That's an ego trip. Wow. To the Odyssey, which cannot, of course, have been written at the same time or by the same person, the Odyssey is an individual's saga. It is not collective. It's individual. All of a sudden, he argues, and I think he's got a point, between these two, something has developed that we would recognize as modern consciousness. Exactly how it happened, he doesn't know. He makes some interesting suggestions. The chief one is that we became more accustomed to language and what it can do. And as we learned to use language more naturally, as language became more flexible and adaptable, so this kind of right brain externalization was no longer necessary. I haven't fully digested the implications of this yet, but it is a most stimulating book. It's been worrying me now for about 5 or 6 weeks since I finished it. And I think there's going to be a story there one day, so I'd better stop talking about it and simply suggest that if you really want to have your skull cracked, go and read this book. I don't know if it exists in German, and it's probably very hard to find in English. But it does? Hooray! Good. Excellent. I'm pleased. He is Professor Julian James, and that's J-A-Y-N-E-S. I shouldn't have gone on at such length about that, but when you run across a really stimulating book, it's a rare and memorable event, and I'm even prepared to take the risk that somebody else in this hall might get to the science fiction version of it before I do.
Okay, we've got 10 minutes left, so I'd like to ask that there's someone else besides me who has any questions to Mr. Brunner.
I still do. My last big book, A Maze of Stars, as sold here in Germany, published in the States last year, nobody in Britain will look at it. And I don't know why. I've often had this trouble in the past. More than a third of my entire output has never been published in my own country. And I don't know why. If I knew why, I'd have done something about it. Sorry. On the whole, yes. I wish it made me twice as much money, but apart from that, I have very few complaints. I have, in fact, benefited from some excellent translators. I'm very lucky.
You were talking about Camden, taking the bar soap approach to the book market. But in America, you are published by that way, which is kind of responsible for generic fantasy phenomenon in America. Why that way? Why not Camden?
Because Del Rey inherited from Ballantine Books. And Ian and Betty Ballantine were the publishers, and I have dealt with many, many publishers. Out of all those I have dealt with, Ian and Betty Ballantine were the nicest people, the most honorable, and in fact, the best publishers. Very, very good people indeed. And when Judy Lynn Del Rey took over, well, I'd known her since she was assistant editor on Galaxy magazine, and we got on generally very well together. So I was quite happy to stay with what became Del Rey Books. As for what else is on the same shelf, well, that's the business of the other authors, not mine. Speaking of generic fantasy, though, one should never forget that after Ace issued a pirated copy of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, it was Ian and Betty Ballantine who got a properly revised edition, properly edited, and fully copyrighted one, and thereby essentially made Tolkien's fortune in his later life. You mean in now? Certainly, yes. I was a founder member of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which was launched in 1958, helped to organize the first Aldermaston March and many others subsequently, eventually decided that I could reach more people by writing books than by walking down the street with a banner. But I was active in the anti-nuclear movement for approximately 25 years. After which time I decided it was somebody else's turn. I was getting tired. I'm sorry? Political problems. I can think of one. And I managed to get over it. When I wrote The Shockwave Rider, I put into it the statement that there was only... you know that to become president in the United States, you have to be immensely rich. I put into the book the argument that there was only one place, apart from old money, so-called, and Texas oil, where sufficient funds could come from to take over the White House. Organized crime. My American publishers wanted that taken out. And I said, no, if you take that out, I will take the book somewhere else. They left it in. The next thing that happened was that Nixon got into the White House. And if anybody here still doesn't know where Nixon got the money to mount his campaign, I suggest you investigate. Very little, I'm afraid. I have just discovered today that my agent for Eastern Europe has turned down at least three deals without telling me. I think the publication of my books in Eastern Europe is going to be rather different in future. I do hate having to worry about business, though. Look, I'm one of the most unbusiness-like people in the world. My job is writing books. I hate Mondays Not for the reason most people hate Mondays. They go back to work after the weekend. Oh, no. It's because Monday, for me, is the day when I answer letters and pay bills. I want to get on with my current book. But I have to get rid of these things. There's an admirable saying that I seem to have known since childhood. True freedom consists in doing first what must be done and then what you want to do, because otherwise what must be done will keep interrupting. I'm afraid this is true.
Maybe one last question, if there's anyone of you, because we've got 4 minutes left and... Oh? Ah, Cliff James.
So you do it in public? When I first set out as a writer, I did it for the fun of it, because I couldn't expect to make a living. When I did eventually earn enough to support myself by writing, I thought, what a wonderful way to earn a living. After the first 20 or 30 books, it became, it's the way I make my living. And now I'm afraid it's the way I have to make my living because I don't know how to do anything else.
Okay, no.
Not really. For me, the best fantasy has the same kind of internal consistency as good science fiction. If you must have magic, then let there be laws of magic, for example. And I remember a very nice distinction being made between good fantasy and bad fantasy. A reviewer once pointed out that Robert E. Howard would give Conan a steel sword without wondering who made the steel. Sprague de Camp, whose work I much preferred, would show his hero with a bronze sword and hammering out the dents in the blade after the battle. That sort of thing I like. And it's what I tried to do in The Traveller in Black in particular. I tried to make it a logical world, but with a different kind of logic from scientific logic. All my favorite fantasy novels have that quality of internal consistency that matches what you find in good science fiction. Oh, golly, I'd better go back and reread The Tritonian Ring.
Okay, our time is running out, so thanks very much to Mr. Brunner for being here and being here for this interview. And it was a great honor to talk to you, because I felt part being transported back to this young boy sitting there, and I've got to say, I'm still fascinated. I hope on another level still. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Standing ovation is the audience that's applauding.
Thank you very much.